What you fear the most rarely comes to pass. That refrain cycled through Bridget Baptiste's mind on a continuous loop as she stood with her flank against the crumbling brick wall. Her heart pumped and her throat constricted as the crowd around her began to go mad. Bridget forced herself to calm down, knowing that Domi and Kane were supremely competent in almost any situation. Still, she felt almost relieved something was finally happening. For the past 2 hours, she had been loitering along a narrow side street, separated by the ruins of two buildings from the main activity of the city. Bridget had visited Manhattan in the 20th century during an abortive time travel mission a few years earlier. What she saw now was scarcely recognizable as the remains of one of the largest metropolises in the world. Centuries of human history had been reduced to hundreds of square miles of smoldering rubble within a handful of minutes. Some of the towers still stood, shattered and cracked, yet with an indomitable appearance. A tall woman with a fair complexion, Bridget's high forehead gave the impression of a probing intellect, whereas her full underlip hinted at an appreciation of the sensual. She wore black denim slacks, loose enough in the leg for free movement, the cuffs tucked into thick-soled combat boots. A camouflage jacket covered her torso. Her waist-length mane of red-gold hair was now a short, tightly bound, sunset-colored braid hanging at her nape. A TP-9 auto pistol was snugged in a cross-draw rig strapped around her waist, and a copperhead subgun hung from a harness beneath her coat. Under 2 feet long, the copperhead had a 700-round-per-minute rate of fire, the extended magazine holding 35 4.85mm steel-jacketed rounds. The grip and trigger units were placed in front of the breech in the bullpup design, allowing for one-handed use. Optical image intensifier scopes and laser auto-targeters were mounted on the top of the frame. Low recoil allowed the copperheads to be fired in long, devastating full-auto bursts. Carefully, she touched the dabs of soot applied to her face to conceal her peaches-and-cream complexion. She knew she would pass a quick visual inspection by a farer or a roamer, but she also knew she didn't smell as rank as they did. However, her devotion to the masquerade had its limits. As it was, her nostrils recoiled at the potpourri of odors wafting on the wind. To Bridget, whose nose had sampled aromas from all over the world, the place simply stank. Bridget crossed the side street, peering past broken walls and over the heads of the assembled farers and roamers. The long yellow vehicle rolled into sight.
On his way.
Acknowledged.
Bridget moved to the throng of roamers closest to the street. Despite herself, she felt the tingling warmth of excitement at the prospect of danger spread through her. For a very long time, she was ashamed of that anticipation, blaming her association with Kane for contaminating her. Now she had accepted the realization that his own desire for thrill-seeking hadn't infected her, but only forced her to accept an aspect of her personality she had always been aware of, but refused to consciously acknowledge. In her years as a baronial archivist, Bridget Baptiste had prided herself on her intellect and logical turn of mind. She was a scholar first and foremost. Back then, the very suggestion she would have been engaged in such work would have made her laugh. Now, she was a veteran warrior, and at some point during her time with Cerberus, she realized the moments of danger no longer terrified her, but brought a sharper sense of being alive. Her life in Cobaltville's historical division had not been a full life, but only an artifice, a puppet show she had performed so the string pullers wouldn't become displeased and direct their grim attention toward her. Of course, eventually, they had. Over the past few years, she had left her tracks in the most distant and alien of climes and breasted very deep, very dangerous waters. The crowd clogging the alley was too densely packed to move among easily, so rather than force her way through the shouting mob, Bridget chose to run parallel to the parade route. As she picked her way through the rubble, she absently noted the ripple pattern spreading across the asphalt. Weeds sprouted from splits in the surface. She had seen the rippling effect many times, mainly in the outlands. It was a characteristic result of earthquakes triggered by nuclear bomb shockwaves. When Bridget came to a knitted mass of wreckage that appeared to be several buildings that had toppled atop one another, she paused to study it, looking for a way through it, or over it, rather than around. A series of concrete slabs formed something of a crude staircase over the top of the rubble, and she began clambering up them. She passed from one section to another until she pulled herself to the summit. Bridget looked toward the street, just as the yellow Cadillac rolled behind a pile of bricks. She saw the broad, dark bulk of Shuma standing in the rear of the vehicle, waving to the mob. She caught only a glimpse of the big black man spread-eagled across the hood, and her heart jumped in her chest. Bridget knew Kane was in contact with the other members of the away team, Brady and Edwards, so she did not linger. Swiftly, she bounded down the face of the rubble heap. The footing wasn't treacherous, but it wasn't particularly trustworthy either. When she reached the base, Bridget started running, hoping to get ahead of the Cadillac and provide support for Brady, Edwards, and Domi, although she knew all three people were experienced. Domi, of course, had lived most of her young life in the wild places, far from the cushioned tyranny of the baronies. She had spent years cautiously treading the ragged edge of death, and her inner fiber had been forged into an iron strength and an implacable stoicism. Edwards and Brady were, like Kane and Grant, former magistrates, and were now trusted members of the Cerberus away teams. Lakesh had initially opposed the formation of the three Cerberus away teams, made uncomfortable by the concept of the redoubt's own version of the magistrate division, ironically composed of former magistrates. However, as the scope of their operations broadened, the personnel situation at the installation also changed. Kane, Grant, Bridget, and Domi couldn't always undertake the majority of the ops, and therefore shoulder the lion's share of the risks. Over the past year and a half, Kane and Grant had set up Cerberus away teams Alpha, Beta, and Delta. Cat Delta was semi-permanently stationed at Redoubt Yankee on Thunder Isle, rotating duty shifts with Nuedo's Tigers of Heaven, and Cat Beta was charged with the security of the redoubt and surrounding territory. A number of former magistrates, weary of fighting for one transitory ruling faction or another that tried to fill the power vacuum in the Vills, responded to the outreach efforts of Cerberus. Diplomacy, turning potential enemies into allies against the spreading reign of the overlords, had become the paramount tactic of Cerberus. Lessons in how to deal with foreign cultures and religions took the place of weapons instruction and other training. Over the past 5 years, Bridget Baptiste, Domi, Kane, and Grant had tramped through jungles and ruined cities, over mountains and across deserts. They had found strange cultures everywhere, often bizarre recreations of societies that had vanished long before the nuke cost. Due in part to her eidetic memory, Bridget spoke a dozen languages and could get along in a score of dialects, but knowing the native tongues of many different cultures and lands was only a small part of her work. Aside from her command of languages, Bridget had made history and geopolitics abiding interests in a world that was changing rapidly. She and all the personnel of Cerberus, more than half a world away atop a mountain peak in Montana, had devoted themselves to changing the nuke-blasted planet into something better. At least that was her earnest hope. To turn hope into reality meant respecting the often alien behavior patterns influenced by a vast number of ancient religions, legends, myths, and taboos. Bridget ran past a scattering of machine parts, her copperhead bumping in an irritating rhythm against her left hip. Most of the rusted hunks of metal were so corroded as to be unidentifiable. Bridget continued along the front row of roofless brownstones. As she crossed an overgrown strip of gravel alley between a pair of buildings, Shuma's vehicle hove back into view. Vaulting over a web of rusty iron pipes, Bridget sprinted to a low brick wall and knelt down behind it, catching her breath. Urgency vibrated along all the sensitive nerve endings of her body. A single shaft of sunlight slipped over the top of the building and cast a shifting yellow halo on the road below. Kane crept closer to the cornice edge and peered through the rifle scope. Straight down the potholed street came the procession, and on either side milled the farers and roamers, lean people wearing rags, but their faces were those of predatory animals. They waved at the vehicle, chugging slowly over the potholed blacktop. In a previous incarnation, some 2 centuries earlier, the long automobile had been a bright yellow Cadillac convertible. Garlands of artificial flowers festooned the bodywork, from the gleaming grillwork to the sharp tail fins. 4 men marched beside the vehicle, hammering on drums made of old metal containers. Although he had never seen him before, Kane had no problem identifying Baron Shuma. An enormous man, stripped to the waist, stood upright in the rear seat, his arms folded over his thick chest. His hairless head was small in proportion to his massive torso. He resembled a toad more than a lizard. His blunt-featured face was coated in overlapping scales of a dark gray-green. His nose was a blob, a lighter shade of gray. His pendulous lips drew back over yellowed teeth in a savage grin. His black-rimmed eyes glittered brightly, even in the dim light. Kane recalled that Lakesh had speculated the Scalies were the descendants of humans modified for war. Most likely, the first generation were little more than expendable fighting machines, with their brains modified to ensure that they remained under the control of those guiding their actions. With a sudden surge of disgust, Kane realized that Shuma was under no one's control. He made that very clear by parading his captive down the street in full view of his subjects. Grant lay spread-eagled on the broad hood of the Cadillac, arms and legs held at painful angles by taut lengths of rope. His olive-drab t-shirt was ripped and stained. Kane was unable to tell if the gleam on his brown-skinned body was from perspiration or blood. Grant was a big man with a heavy musculature. His black hair was sprinkled with gray at the temples. Beneath the fierce, down-sweeping mustache, black against the dark brown of his skin, his teeth were bared, either in a silent snarl or a rictus of pain. Kane adjusted the scope and sighted through the lens. He gauged the distance at 250 yards. Domi inched her way to the edge of the sidewalk, pushing in front of a short, flat-faced man wearing a ragged Mackinaw and a beat-up bottle-green derby. Judging by his clothes, he was a farer. Roamers tended to prefer clothes made of animal hide, which reflected their more barbaric mindsets. The man shot Domi a hostile glance, but she ignored him. Her belly slipped sideways as she sighted the yellow Cadillac and the big man spread-eagled across the hood like a hunting trophy. Word had traveled fast through Shuma's followers that he had captured Grant, one of the renegade Baron Blasters. The term Baron Blaster was old, deriving from the rebels who had staged a violent resistance against the institution of the Unification Program a century before. Domi knew that neither Kane nor Grant enjoyed having the appellation applied to them. Their vil upbringing still lurked close to the surface, and they had been taught that the so-called Baron Blasters were worse than outlaws, but were instead terrorists incarnate. Regardless, the reputations of the core Cerberus warriors had grown too awesome, too great over the past 5 years for even the most isolated outlander to be ignorant of their accomplishments, even if it was an open question of just how many of the stories were based in truth and how many were overblown fable. With a conscious effort, Domi tore her gaze away from Grant, at once relieved that he did not appear to be seriously hurt, and enraged that he was injured at all. Beneath the overhang of her hood, she watched Shuma intently, only vaguely aware that there was something not right about him beyond his obvious physical deformity. She had seen and even killed Scalies before, but her belly still roiled with nausea, and her hand automatically went to the hilt of her long knife, fingering the pommel. For 6 months, she had been enslaved by Guana Teague, the pit boss of Cobaltville, and she had never forgotten the greenish tint of his skin and its odd, faintly scaled pattern. A number of people had suspected that Guana had a Scaly in the family, hence his nickname. The loathing for her former master still ran deep within Domi, even years after slitting his throat with the very same knife that now was sheathed at her hip. Shuma's reptilian appearance didn't trigger a mental alarm, since he looked pretty much like the other Scaly she had seen. Her eyes focused on the figure slouched in the seat beside him. He was a very small man, probably no more than 4'5". However, a massive, almost rectangular head rose from between a pair of downsloping shoulders. The pale flesh of his freakishly high forehead showed a blue and red network of broken blood vessels spreading up to his hairline. His mouth was a short, lipless gash. His ash-gray hair was thin, almost downy, stirred slightly by the breeze atop his flat skull. A great shelf of bone jutted above his eyes. They were unusual in shape and color, disproportionately large, completely round, with tiny irises and pupils totally surrounded by the whites. They seemed to glow like two pinpoints of fire. His eyes swept the crowd disinterestedly. Suddenly they came to rest on Domi. In that instant, she felt a faint touch on the surface of her mind, as if it had been brushed by a cobweb. His eyes moved on, but she instantly realized what the little man was. She opened her contact to Kane's channel.
Kane?
Here, Domi.
Car's about 20 yards away.
What is it?
Not sure. I see something that...
Domi had caught only the impression of an arm whipping toward her from behind. She ducked, but the hard object had struck the side of her head just under her ear. She would have fallen into the street if not for the press of bodies all around her. Senses reeling, fighting off unconsciousness, Domi moved on pure animal instinct. A vague figure jerked away from her 9-inch serrated blade. Domi saw the flat-faced man in the derby flail at her with a metal truncheon. She sidestepped and slashed again. Domi saw the man stumble backward, clutching at his right arm. Blood seeped between his fingers. As a hand closed in a painful grip on the back of her neck, Domi leaned forward, her left leg flashing up in a back kick. A heavyset man doubled over, clutching at his groin. More people shuffled toward Domi, arms spread wide to prevent her from bolting into the crowd. She backed away, weaving and swaying, reaching under her coat for her auto pistol. She pivoted on her heel and ran full out up the boulevard in the opposite direction from which Shuma and his entourage had come.
Baptiste, can you see Domi?
No, why?
She was cut off.
Cut off how?
How the hell do I know? That's why I'm calling you.
Do you think something has happened to her?
I guess we'll find out.
That's no answer. Until we know what's happened to her, we should scrub the mission.
There's no time for that.
Damn it, King!
Sir, I've got Shuma dead center. I haven't heard from Domi.
Commander, I just tried checking in with Domi, but she didn't respond. Do we scrub?
Stand by. Everybody, just stand by.
We need to pull back and regroup before—
Shut up, Baptiste.
The Cadillac lurched as the tires rolled into a rut, and Shuma reached out a claw-tipped hand to steady himself. Kane settled the rubber-cushioned stock of the OICW into the hollow of his shoulder and held his breath. The skin between his shoulder blades seemed to tighten, and the short hairs at the back of his neck tingled. Domi was running as fast as she could, sensing her enemies not far behind. She knew she wouldn't get far, but she didn't intend to. She reached for her combat harness, and her hand closed around a small, metal-walled sphere. Pulling it from the harness, leaving the pin behind, Domi launched it over her shoulder and threw herself to the ground. A hellflower bloomed from the grenade, sending petals of flame curving and spreading outward. Spewing from the end of every petal was a rain of shrapnel, ripping into bodies and the facades of buildings. Fragments showered the half-fallen wall behind which Domi had taken cover. Domi caught glimpses of men staggering backward with their hands clapped over their ruined faces. Other people stared in wide-eyed shock, frozen in horror. Domi spotted a pair of men standing on opposite sides of the street fall hard to the ground, their heads misshapen by the high-powered bullets. Domi knew the bullets had been fired by Brady and Edwards. Kane passed across the rooftop with a long-legged stride. As soon as he had seen the geyser of steam burst from the Cadillac's radiator, he dropped the OICW, leaped to his feet, and started running. His face wore a grin of pure satisfaction.
Kane, what the hell is going on?
Keep standing by.
I've been standing by. I need to...
Kane cut the channel. He knew she would heap vituperation on him when next they spoke, but he couldn't afford a distraction. It sounded to Kane like Edwards and Brady were taking the initiative. He wasn't concerned about leaving the OICW behind. His first priority was reaching street level as soon as possible, so he concentrated on running. The Sin-Eater, snugged in its forearm holster, weighed considerably less than the rifle, although the four grenades attached to the combat webbing beneath his jacket bounced painfully against his ribs. Reaching the other end of the roof, Kane leaped nimbly over a haphazard heap of unidentifiable junk. He angled away from the cupola enclosing the stairway. He had no inclination to be trapped in the stairwell by enraged roamers, whom he was sure were on their way up. Obeying an impulse triggered by his point man sense, Kane had decided to stop Shuma's vehicle rather than snipe at live targets. He wasn't sure why he had reached his decision, but he put a great faith in his instincts as a general rule. Something about Shuma and his big-headed companion, some small, almost unidentifiable stimulus, had triggered the mental alarm. Sprinting across the flat surface of the roof, he reached the edge. Kane took the alleyway, yawning before him in a single leap. He misjudged the distance to the adjacent building and landed too hard, falling onto his right side and rolling over and over. He slammed up against the brick facade of a chimney.
Shit.
Kane quickly examined the scrapes on the palms of his hands, then rose to a knee. He cast a glance over his shoulder back to the rooftop from which he'd come. A pair of bearded roamers stood outside the cupola, looking this way and that. Both men cradled lightweight deer rifles in their arms. Kane gauged the weapons to be .22 caliber, and therefore they had little stopping power unless the shooters were very accurate. He assumed the roamers would be, so he sidled out of sight on the opposite side of the chimney. The two men glared around with wild, angry eyes, and when they spotted the OICW lying on the rooftop, they jogged toward it. Cain took advantage of their distraction to rise for his escape.
Shit! He's gone!
A bullet drilled into a stack of lumber on Cain's right, throwing up a little cloud of splinters. Increasing his speed and the length of his stride, he reached the far edge of the roof and dived off it to the building 15 feet below. Cain landed on the balls of his feet and then threw himself forward into a somersault. The layer of rotting wood and roofing material sagged beneath his weight and collapsed inward. He fell amid a seething cascade of plaster, drywall, boards, insulation, and broken rafters. He hadn't fallen far, but the impact still very nearly jolted all the wind from his lungs. His vision blurred. Cain dragged himself up to his hands and knees. The swirl of dust and dirt particles stung his eyes and coated his tongue. Fanning the air in front of his face, Cain staggered to his feet and glanced up at the ragged hole his hurtling body had made in the ceiling. He doubted the roamers would risk following him. They no doubt hoped he had broken his neck or his back in the fall. Kneading the small of his back, Cain squinted through the dust, seeing a hallway piled high with the detritus of 2 centuries. Though the light was dim, he moved toward the mouth of a stairwell. Dark doorways yawned on both sides of the passage. He saw only shambles inside the rooms and evidence they were used as nests for vermin. The interior smelled stale and musty. Carefully, he moved down the weakened steps, wincing at every sagging step beneath his boots. The banister wobbled at his touch. He keyed his contact.
Status, Baptiste?
Shuma threw himself over that weird little man. Edwards and Brady have been shooting into the crowd, keeping anybody from getting too close to Grant. I haven't seen Domi, but I know she was the one who... Stand by.
Baptiste!
The crowd ran in a panicked rush that bowled people off their feet and trampled more than a few of them. Domi stayed behind the wall as the main mass of the crowd had passed. She resheathed her knife, then rose to her feet. She lunged back in the direction she had come, plunging through the smoke. She drew her combat master, appreciating the feel of the checkered walnut grip against the palm of her right hand. A roamer, blood streaming from a shrapnel-inflicted gash on his cheek, jumped in her path, his discolored teeth bared. Domi clubbed him across the mouth with the barrel of her auto pistol. Ahead, she saw a dark-complexioned man wearing a yellow turban racing toward Grant with a 3-foot-long sword held over his head, readying himself to deliver a decapitating blow. Moving on impulse, almost without thought, Domi leveled her auto pistol and adjusted for elevation and windage. 2 .45-caliber bullets hit the man, one in the center of his turban and the other in his neck. He catapulted backward amid a spouting of blood. 20 yards was a long range for the handgun, especially aiming at a moving target, but Domi had made far more difficult shots. The people around the turbaned man scattered at the sound of the shots, but because the majority of the crowd was composed of hard-bitten, violence-prone roamers, they didn't indulge in a panic-stricken flight. They took cover, either in the ruins, or they dropped flat to the street, eyes and guns seeking targets. Domi glimpsed the huge, dark bulk of Shuma hustling away from the Cadillac, a limp shape cradled protectively in his arms. She guessed the Scaly was ferrying his small companion away to safety, but she couldn't understand why he would care. She didn't devote any further thought to the matter. She kept her gaze fixed on Grant as he strained against the bond that held him to the hood of the vehicle. Wisps of steam from the punctured radiator still curled around him like an early morning fog. Through a part in the vapors, Domi saw a scar-faced woman with a bizarre purple-tinged mohawk haircut shouldering her way through the press of bodies, using the stock of a Stoner machine gun to hammer a path. Her narrowed eyes were turned toward Grant. Domi sighted down the length of her pistol, aiming at a spot between the woman's exposed, tattooed breasts. Too late, she sensed a rushing body behind her. Arms encircled her in an agonizingly tight grip, lifting her from the ground. She smelled stale sweat and hot, rancid breath washed over her cheek. As she tried to bring up her pistol, the arms tightened around her in a crushing embrace, pumping all the air from her lungs. Gasping, she kicked backward, the edge of her boot heel striking his shin. Her next tactic was to butt the man with the back of her head. This move was hardly more effective than the first. The pressure of his pinioning arms increased, closing like the jaws of a vise. Through blurry eyes, Domi saw the bare-breasted woman raising her stoner, resting the stock against her hip, the hollow bore staring at her like a cyclopean eye. Domi struggled wildly. A short tongue of flame lipped from the muzzle. Domi felt the man holding her jerk violently as if he received a blow. His grip loosened, and his arms fell away altogether. Domi stumbled when the man dropped, but she saw the neat red-rimmed hole in the middle of his forehead and the far-from-neat cavity at the rear of his skull. She threw the Mohawked woman an uncomprehending stare. She smiled back at Domi in amusement, inclined her head in a nod, and gestured with her auto-rifle toward Grant.
He's all yours, sweetheart.
The woman turned and merged back into the bustling crowd. Breathing hard, Domi reached Grant, drawing her knife.
What kind of rescue plan is this? To parboil my ass?
The cane kind.
Why did I even have to ask?
Domi couldn't help smiling as the big man came free. Although he looked bruised and battered, the fact that he could complain and criticize meant he wasn't hurt too severely. As Grant pushed himself off the hood of the Cadillac and stood, massaging his wrists, Bridget Baptiste pounded up, holding her TP-9 in a two-fisted grip. Her green eyes glinted, bright with worry.
Are you all right, Grant? Do you need medical treatment?
Maybe later.
Domi, we lost contact with you and almost scrubbed the op.
I took a wallop there. Mashed up my contact, but probably kept me from a broken head. Where's Kane and everybody else?
I just spoke to him. He, Edwards, and Brady are on their way to us. Once we rendezvous, let's get to the jump chamber and gate back to Cerberus. I've pretty much had my fill of New York, New York.
Yeah, it's a hell of a town, but we can't leave it right now.
Why the hell not?
They turned as Kane jogged up. His dark hair was white with plaster dust, his face and clothes coated with a pale film. A little cloud of dust trailed behind him, indicating his path.
What happened to you? Too much standing by?
Lucky guess.
Why didn't you just shoot Shuma?
And I'm so happy to see you, too.
Thanks for saving my life, okay? Now tell me why you saved it the way you did.
I'm not really sure. I had him in my sights, but then I got the feeling he wasn't the real brains behind this whole SOB deal. I also got the feeling that if I blew his brains out in front of this crowd of scum, I'd be making a martyr, not ending a threat. Not to mention that every roamer in the vicinity would have tried to carve the best pieces off you in retaliation.
I'm impressed. That actually makes sense, unlike most of your make-shit-up-as-we-go-along plans.
If we're lucky, we jump-started some old roamer clan feuds in the process of getting you back.
Heh! What else is new?
Grant, Kane, and Bridget understood Domi's oblique reference. It often seemed that wherever the Cerberus team went, violence and death were only moments away. It was rarely planned that way, but terrible and bloody events always happened, and the body count soared. Bridget had once opined that they were avatars, catalysts, triggering eruptions and explosions of savagery that had simmered at a low boil for a long time.
If Shuma isn't the guiding intelligence behind the SOB, then who is?
Little Big Head Man. Right, Grant?
You don't know how right. You say Edwards and Brady are with you?
Yeah. They'll be along. Did you find Wright?
I did, I'm sorry to say. Let's go get her.
Shuma's headquarters were situated between a pair of overgrown knolls on the far side of Central Park. Rather than expend time and effort on stealth, the Cerberus warriors opted to proceed the magistrate way, head on and determined to shoot, stab, and slug their way through any obstacles. Brady and Edwards walked flanking point, wielding their OICW rifles and glowering at everyone who glanced in their direction. Both ex-magistrates, the two men were of a type. The shaved-headed Edwards stood over 6 feet tall, very broad of build, with overdeveloped triceps, biceps, and deltoids. Brady was equally bulked up, but slightly shorter. His blonde hair was little more than bristles covering his scalp. He and Edwards were dressed similarly in black t-shirts, green-striped camo pants, and high-laced jump boots. In addition to their rifles, the two men carried H&K VP-70 auto pistols in belly holsters. Kane, Grant, Domi, and Bridget marched purposefully side by side through the nearly deserted camp of the Survivalist Outland Brigade. All four people knew walking in such a fashion was tactically unwise, but they also knew by doing so they were making a theatrical, defiant statement to any roamers or farers they might meet. Anyone who lived near any of the baronies had heard tales of Kane and Grant, the two rogue magistrates who had continually escaped and outwitted all the traps laid for them by various barons of different bills. No two men over the past 200 years had reputations to equal theirs, even if it was an open question of just how many of the stories were based in truth and how many of them were overblown fable. For their part, Kane and Grant found that blurring the lines of demarcation between legend and fact had proved very useful on occasion. They were credited with killing Baron Ragnar in his own bed, and although no one knew how they had managed it, they were also held responsible for the fall of the Vils and disappearance of the Barons. The four of them strode through the camp, grim-faced and single-minded, and weren't confronted. The few people they had encountered so far either scattered behind trees or sank to the ground as if hoping they would be mistaken for lumps in the terrain. Some of them were so dirty they blended in almost perfectly.
Doesn't look like anybody's inclined to interfere with us.
We're pretty scary when we want to be. Sometimes, even when we don't want to be.
Ouch!
Grant found it difficult to maintain an implacable facade since he walked in his bare feet and occasionally stepped on a sharp object. The majority of the people who had made up the SOB had already packed up their belongings and departed from the sprawling camp. Unlike the roamers, the Ferrer element of the SOB wasn't enthusiastic about participating in clan feuds. The Ferrers were too fixated on mere survival to engage in random and gratuitous acts of violence.
Woo-hoo!
Good thing the Merry Widow didn't hold a grudge.
Too soon to say about a roamer. Most of them only came here for the chance of free food or finding underage slaves. They were already primed to start slaughtering one another.
Grant's parade was just a diversion. This whole enterprise would have fallen apart anyway. It wasn't worth the life of Wright. I'd say we did what we set out to do. The Survivalist Outland Brigade has disbanded.
You wouldn't say that if you'd met Esau. If we don't stop him here, he'll start up someplace else.
He's just one more mind muty with an attitude. We've dealt with his type before.
He's a mind muty with an attitude who knows a whole hell of a lot about us, about Cerberus, about our tech and our defenses. That makes him damn dangerous.
The more he knows about us, then the less he would want us to pay any attention to him.
No, Bridget. There's something about that little son of a bitch. He's powerful, he's ambitious, and he's flat out evil.
Kane regarded Grant with surprise, since the man very rarely spoke in moral absolutes. The fact that he had done so meant Esau had shaken him profoundly to his emotional core. Although he looked too huge and solid to have many abilities beyond sheer strength, Grant was an exceptionally intelligent and talented man. Behind the man's fierce, deep-set eyes, down-sweeping mustache, granite jaw, and broken nose, lay a mind rich with tactics, strategies, and painful experience.
Here we are.
The team gazed silently at the structure that served as the SOB headquarters, noting it was far larger than any of the huts, long and rambling, with a covered veranda running its entire length.
I think this place used to be a restaurant. A pretty famous one, too.
Brady, Edwards, take up positions on either side of the main entrance.
You got it, sir.
I'm going in first.
Neither Grant, Domi, nor Bridget objected. Kane always assumed the position of point man. It was a habit he had acquired during his years as a magistrate, and he saw no reason to abandon it. His three teammates had the utmost faith in Kane's instincts. During his mag days, because of his uncanny ability to sniff out approaching danger, he was always chosen to act as the advance scout. When he walked point, Kane felt electrically alive, sharply tuned to every nuance of his surroundings and what he was doing. When he reached the steps leading up to the veranda, he fell into a crouch, stiffening his right wrist tendons. The sensitive actuators clicked on, and the butt of his sin-eater slapped into his hand. The official sidearm of the defunct magistrate divisions, the 9mm auto pistol, had no safety or trigger guard, so when the firing stud came in contact with a crooked index finger, it fired immediately. However, Kane kept his finger extended and out of contact with the trigger stud.
I'm going in. Keep alert.
Yes, sir. Got it, Commander.
Creeping up the sagging steps, he entered the open door of the building. By the amber beam of his Nighthawk flashlight strapped around his right wrist, he saw a big, open space full of rickety-looking chairs and tables. The cloying stench of human sweat, marijuana, and an untended latrine clung to the air.
Brady, Edwards, move on in. Baptiste, you, Domi, and Grant can come up, too. I think this place is deserted.
As Edwards and Brady entered, Kane moved deeper into the room. He found a flare-topped kerosene lantern on one of the tables. The fuel well was full. He reached into his pocket with his right hand, producing the simple flint and steel lighter he carried. The two ex-mags carefully scanned the area, walking heel to toe. The pale yellow radiance showed very little, except rough-hewed furniture and a very dirty floor. He saw a table holding Grant's clothing and his boots. He pointed out the items to Bridget, Domi, and Grant.
I was wondering what happened to those.
Grant sat on a stool and pulled on his boots.
Nobody's here. They cleared out with the rest of the scum.
They didn't take Wright with them. Look at the far end of the room.
Brady and Edwards moved in the direction Grant indicated, sidling among the tables. They used their nighthawks to illuminate their way. The amber glow cast a sickly illumination on the maimed body of the woman, still dangling from the meat hooks. Reflexively, Bridget put a hand to her mouth, but she didn't turn away, and neither did Domi. Both of them had witnessed any number of atrocities over the years, and although they weren't inured to them, they no longer overtly reacted with horror to the sight. Cain placed the lamp on a table and stared over at her body.
Why the fuck would he do that to her?
Because he could.
Like you said, evil.
Can't you get her down from there?
Brady, Edwards, see what you can do.
The two men leaned their rifles against the wall in a corner and walked around the woman's hanging body, examining how deeply the hooks were sunk into it. Both of their faces remained dispassionate masks, as per their training. Like Grant and Cain, they had been taught the technique of detaching themselves from their emotions in the performance of ghastly chores. Edwards pulled up a chair and climbed atop it, while Brady took hold of Wright's legs and pushed upward. Edwards detached the sharp points of the hooks from the woman's flesh and muscle. Working together, they carefully lifted her down, carrying her over to a large table. With a surprisingly gentle touch, the pair of ex-mags laid her down and folded her arms over her chest. Edwards pulled her lids down over her glazed eyes.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Brady nodded at Bridget, then returned to the corner to retrieve their weapons. As he turned to retrace his steps, he stopped suddenly, a frown creasing his forehead.
What is it?
I think the floor's hollowed out over here.
Setting aside the rifles, Brady shone his flash down, illuminating a thread-thin outline of a trapdoor.
This must be how the bastards got away.
Brady jammed the steel blade of his combat knife into the narrow slit between the edge of the hatch and the flooring.
It's locked from the underside, but I can jimmy it.
Cold suddenly brushed Kane's spine, and alarm jerked through the nerve endings of his body.
Brady, get away from the...
The eruption of flame dazzled everyone's eyes, and the detonation nearly deafened them. The concussion was like a battering ram of hot, almost solid air swatting Cain backward, cartwheeling him head over heels. Cain lay motionless for a moment, eyes stinging from the smoke, the stink of scorched human flesh, and the chemical reek of kerosene and high explosives thick in his nostrils. Dizzy, ears ringing, Cain fought to his feet, clearing his vision with swipes of his hands. He peered through the scraps of smoke, settling dust and swirling wood particles. He barely made out a welter of smoldering, splintered floorboards, punched up from below. There was no sign of Brady. The explosion had overturned the lamp, but had snuffed out the wick before it could ignite the spilled kerosene. Cain cast his flash toward his friends, but at first he couldn't see them through billowing smoke. Cain saw Grant, Domi, Bridget, and Edwards slowly staggering to their feet, looking around dazedly. Except for a couple of raw nicks on Edwards' bare arms, nobody looked injured.
Booby-trapped. Should have figured.
I did, but about 2 seconds too late. Is everybody all right?
Yeah, I think so. Domi?
Yeah. Where's Brady?
Edwards stumbled through the plains of smoke, kicking rubble out of his way, stepping over Wright's body. The beam of his flashlight cut pale threads through the roiling vapors.
Here he is.
Cain, Bridget, Grant, and Domi moved to Brady's side, fanning away smoke. They saw Edwards kneeling beside a blackened, man-shaped scarecrow. Brady's face was covered by red, raw patches. His shirt hung in tatters, clinging to the third-degree burns on his torso.
He's still alive. Just barely, and God knows how, but he's still alive.
Cain gazed down at what was left of Brady's face, and anger built inside him. It was an impersonal kind of anger, subsumed by resolve. He knew with a great and irrevocable certainty that neither he nor Grant nor Bridget would leave Manhattan until they found the man responsible for setting the trap and for murdering Wright. Bridget touched Brady's arm.
We need to get him to the gateway and back to Cerberus as soon as possible if there's any chance of saving his life.
Edwards, give Grant your sidearm.
Edwards peered at him in confusion, then unholstered the VP-70.
I don't understand.
You and Domi can rig up a litter to carry Brady to the gateway. I'm afraid we'll have to leave right where she is for the time being.
What are you gonna do, Kane?
Baptiste, Grant, and I are gonna track down Shuma and Esau.
Just the three of you?
The three heads of Cerberus.
Edwards nodded grimly in understanding and began attending to Brady. Grant checked the action of the VP-70.
You'd better get moving before it gets much darker, Edwards.
I'll make sure Brady gets home. Don't worry about that.
Both Grant and Kane knew that the bond between magistrates could sometimes be closer than those shared by family members. For most mags, the divisions in which they served took the place of conventional family units, and their fellow enforcers were brothers and shield mates. A century before, magistrate divisions were formed as a complex police machine that demanded instant obedience to its edicts and to which there was no possible protest. Over the past century, both the oligarchy of barons and the mags who served them had taken on a fearful, almost legendary aspect. Kane and Grant had been part of that legend, cogs in a merciless machine. All magistrates followed a patrilineal tradition, assuming the duties and positions of their fathers before them. They did not have given names, each taking the surname of the father, as though the first magistrate to bear the name were the same man as the last. The originators of the magistrate divisions had believed that family names engendered a sense of obligation to the duties of their ancestors' office, ensuring that subsequent generations never lost touch with their hereditary roles as enforcers. Last names became badges of social distinction, almost titles. But old magistrate habits died very hard, particularly because of the rigorous discipline to which they had submitted themselves. Casting aside their identities as mags and accepting new roles as rebels and exiles hadn't been easy for either Kane or Grant, and it was doubly difficult for former enforcers like Edwards and Brady, who had been driven from their respective vills after the infrastructure of baronial authority collapsed. Although they never admitted it to each other, Kane and Grant sometimes yearned to return to the regimentation and routine of their former lives. If nothing else, the world had made more sense back then. Kane moved to the splintered ruin of the trapdoor, towing aside the flinders as he examined it.
Looks like a grenade was wired to the catch.
Bridget shone her flash into the dark aperture, looking past the jagged fragments of wood that edged it. The light did not penetrate very far, but a faint foul odor rose from the opening, carrying with it the fetid reek of sewage. The metal rungs of a ladder ran down one side of the shaft into the dimness. The walls were made of heavy, mortared concrete blocks. The shaft was a perfect circle, 6 feet in diameter.
This must go down into the sewer system.
Appropriate.
You two are taking this very personally. Don't get reckless.
Kane smiled coldly at Bridget. Although in his youth he had been a hellion who haughtily charged headlong into danger, now he was less the happy lunatic than a seasoned warrior who had a natural tendency to hesitate before climbing down into a foul-smelling black hole.
I'll go first if you want.
Why break with tradition, Grant?
If you're not back in Cerberus an hour after we get there, I'm coming back here with enough firepower to level this whole fucking island. So don't go sightseeing.
That's the kind of timetable I like to work under, Domi. Thanks.
Kane sat down on the edge of the aperture and inched his legs over the hole, then eased over the edge. Grant waited until he had descended halfway before swinging his own legs over and out. Bridget followed Grant. The ladder rungs descended about 20 feet. At the bottom of the shaft, they sank ankle-deep in mud and algae, staring into a tube made of rusty metal, featureless except for ridges where the sections of pipe were welded. It stretched out as far as they could see. Bridget, Kane, and Grant put on dark-lensed glasses. The electrochemical polymer of the lenses gathered all available light and made the most of it to give them a limited form of night vision. Kane eased out into the shaft, sin-eater in hand, walking heel to toe in the characteristic way of a mag penetrating a potential kill zone. Bridget followed, with Grant bringing up the rear. The tube was narrow, its diameter not permitting them to walk side by side or to stand fully upright. The metal walls dripped with slime. Now and then they curved, first left, then right. Casting the amber beams of their flashlights ahead of them, they walked as quickly as the slippery footing allowed. The shaft sloped sharply upward, and water dripped down steadily from splits in the welds.
That's not a good sign.
Why not?
We could be walking under the East River, or a reservoir.
Kane tamped down a surge of claustrophobia, but he kept moving forward through the putrid quagmire, his back beginning to ache from being bent over. The tunnel leveled out, and he thought he saw a glimmer of light far in the distance. It wavered like a ghostly candle flame. The shaft opened onto a ledge overlooking a concrete channel sunk 10 or so feet below it. On either side reared high bulwarks of stone. The brickwork and concrete blocks were coated by damp green moss. The man-made canal stretched to a circular grating made of rusted metal slats, through which water flowed sluggishly. The three people climbed down a short ladder to the edge of the channel and walked toward the gate. Rats, some of them as big as domestic cats, scuttled away on their approach. A few of the bolder ones stopped after their initial fright and reared up on their hind legs to sniff at them as they passed by. Bridget did a very good job of repressing a shudder of revulsion. Her loathing for rodents went far deeper than a simple antipathy for filth-wallowing vermin. A few years before, she had undergone a nightmarish experience with plague-infected rats in the bayous of Louisiana. They walked swiftly toward the grate. Kane glanced wearily at the dark water as it bubbled and roiled beside them. It seemed as if something very large stirred on the bottom, aware of their presence. Reaching the grate, Grant put his shoulder against it.
Won't budge.
That sounded like a lock on the other side.
Inserting his hands between the iron slats, Kane touched a heavy chain and a padlock.
It's buttoned up, but I can probably pick the lock open.
Bridget turned to the rear, noting a surging motion in the shadows on either side of the channel. The amber beam of her light glinted from tiny red sparks that seemed to ooze out of the gloom. The flashlight beam illuminated a multitude of beady eyes, whiskered snouts, and champing incisor teeth. She couldn't help but cringe against the wall. Puzzled, Grant and Kane turned their heads toward her.
Rats!
What about them?
Bridget unlimbered her copperhead, placing the butt of it against her shoulder.
This brings back memories, not very nice ones. They're regrouping for an attack.
How the hell can that be?
Esau, he's controlling them. Has to be.
Even so, a couple dozen rats aren't going to give us much trouble.
The dark water in the channel erupted. A huge shape heaved itself out of the muck. Despite the mud clinging to its scaled and armored form, the hide was pale, almost a fishbelly white. A set of fang-lined jaws flew open.
Oh, shit! Oh, don't tell me!
Afraid so! One of the legendary alligators in the sewers!
And under the control of Esau, just like the goddamn rats.
The alligator looked to be about 10 feet long, with splotches of yellow running along its thick, glistening body. With several lumbering steps and its stubby legs, the reptile climbed completely out of the channel. Its jaws gaped wide, showing the very dark ivory points of many teeth. Kane's stomach jumped in adrenaline-fueled spasms. Although he had always prided himself on being free of phobias, he had developed a fear of things reptilian over the past few years. It wasn't an irrational fear, but one derived from terrifying first-hand experience. Bridget switched on the Copperhead's laser auto-targeter and centered a pinpoint of blood-hued light between the creature's eyes.
You'd think it would be more interested in eating rats than us.
Would you, Baptiste?
Kane slid his sin-eater back into the forearm holster, then drew his combat knife and put his hands through the metal slats again. His fingers fumbled with the lock, probing at it at the point of the blade.
Just keep it off my ass long enough for me to get this open.
Keeping the gator off your ass is one thing. The rats are another.
Just do the best you can. Oh, what the hell?
Kane's heart leapt as a heavy, calloused hand suddenly closed around his right wrist, squeezing it in a powerful grip. He tried to thrust it back through the bars, but he had no leverage.
Is Grant with you?
Kane squinted between the slats, seeing a tall, scar-faced woman sporting a ridiculously high crest of hair.
Yeah, he's right behind me. Can I tell him the Merry Widow is inquiring about him?
You're Kane, right?
That's me. Pleased to make your formal acquaintance after all these years.
Step back. I'm gonna shoot the lock off.
Up against the wall, you two.
Bridget and Grant obeyed, their eyes and gun barrels still trained upon the hissing alligator and the swarming rodents.
Come on!
Grant and Kane plunged through the portal. Bridget backed her way toward it. The alligator lunged toward her, its dripping jaws gaping wide. Every round from her blast plunged into the reptile's dark gullet. The alligator went into convulsions, writhing and thrashing, its body spasming wildly. The muscular tail whiplashed and sent rats flying. The creature flipped and rolled madly, as if its brain refused to admit that its body was dying. Rolling over, it crushed several rats beneath it, then fell into the channel. The heavy, flailing tail spewed sheets of muddy water cascading over the concrete floor. The Cerberus warriors followed the Merry Widow as she rushed out into a deep culvert. Two of her men stood nearby. One of them wore a scarlet headband, and the other had a single loop of silver hanging from his nose. Both men glared at the three people with thinly disguised hatred.
Thanks.
Don't mention it. You're after Shuma, right?
Right. And that sick little mind mutie, Esau.
I know where they are. Do you want me to lead you to them?
Why would you make that offer?
I don't like muties, and I especially don't like muties with toods.
There's a little more to it than that. A hell of a lot of scummy roamers and slag-assed farers are suddenly without a leader to rally around, right?
Wouldn't you rather have somebody like me in charge than Shuma?
I haven't really thought about it, but if you know where Shuma and Esau have holed up, why don't you smoke them out yourself?
I tried. I chased him down, and I'm pretty sure I winged Shuma, but he was shielding Esau with his body. I decided to let you three have a crack at him.
Of course, if we three take care of him, none of his followers will hold you responsible for his death.
Something like that.
Point taken. Lead on.